Mexico International and Building Industrial Building. Dale Hillary will present arguments for the light board announcement. Mr. Fraser, welcome.
May it please the court. I will be arguing on behalf of the defendant, Relator, in the underlying cause of action. Here today also is Mr. Miles Zaremski, who is representing DeSoto, Inc. He is here. He will not argue. I will argue on behalf of all the parties. And also with him is Ms. Elizabeth Pratt, who represents Carroll Company and the Jones Blair Paint Company. This is a mandamus action brought jointly by the plaintiffs in the underlying case, as well as 10 of the 18 corporate defendants in this case, against the Honorable Adolph Canales, judge of the 298th District Court of Dallas County, by reason of his appointing a Master of Chancery under Rule 171. The issues for the corporate defendants, as well as for the plaintiffs, are two primary issues. First, appointing the Master in Chancery in this case violates the open course provision of the Texas Constitution. Secondly, the respondent committed a clear abuse of discretion in appointing the Master in Chancery under Rule 171. Less than 6 months after this case had been on file, the respondent, sua sponte, ordered a Master in Chancery. This initial order, which is in Exhibit B of the brief, provides that Mr. Sibley will be Master in Chancery and that the cost for his fees will be assessed equally, one half to the plaintiffs, one half to the defendants. Also, that his duties would be primarily for pretrial matters. The respective parties filed objections. A hearing was held. Interestingly, at the hearing, the respondent stated that it was not a complex case, but that there were a lot of documents, and it took up a lot of the court's time. After the hearing, the court rendered his amended order, wherein he stated that it was an exceptional case, it was complex, and ordered the plaintiff to pay throughout the term of the litigation $200 a month and each corporate defendant $550 initially and thereafter to sustain a trust account of $3,000 throughout the course of the litigation. That initial assessment before any discovery motion would be presented to the master amounted to $10,100. The first point. This violates the open court provision of the Texas Constitution, Article 1, Section 13.
Which does? The appointment of a master at all, or the funding, or what aspect of it?
The nature of appointing the master in chancery as far as the fees. This court addressed this issue not too long ago, of course, in LaCour versus Hanlon. This involves the access portion of the open court provision.
Okay, so it's not the contention that you're not getting to talk to the judge. It violates the Constitution.
Well,
that's not Rule 171 ab initio.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Yes, that is correct. We are not saying that Rule 171 ab initio is unconstitutional. Here, there is a unconstitutional violation to the access of the courts that had.
That's solely because of the money.
Primarily, yes.
Primarily or solely?
Well, also, Your Honor, the Master in Chancery is being appointed to do the duties of the duly elected judge. The order, as you'll note, is very broad, saying whatever powers are in 171. But primarily, yes, is the assessment of unreasonable fees, as this court discussed in the Court versus Hanlon and other cases, that we contend violates the open course. There are two aspects of the open course provision. One is the access guarantee. All litigants, this applies to both plaintiffs and defendants, are entitled to have their day in court, as this court has phrased. Secondly, there is the right of redress, which is to actually, you're in the court, but somehow your cause of action is prohibited, limited, such as the cap in the medical malpractice cases. Here, this is an access case. LaCroix versus Hanlon was an access case. In that case, this court held that the additional $40 filing fee that was propounded by the Omnibus House bill was unconstitutional because it went to non-court-related purposes. This court held that not all filing fees and court costs or constitutional. Even if, this court held, the filing fee went to court-related purposes, And we contend that there's an argument that it does not in this case. Even if it did, it still must be reasonable. That's the test. Is it reasonable?
Has the district judge in this case announced what consequence would follow the refusal to pay the fee as ordered?
That would be, he has not stated in his order, but I would submit that it would probably be cause for dismissal because they're not complying with the court's order, be held for contempt. But he did not expressly address that at the hearing or in the order. But the order does provide a manner for the payment, and if we want to appeal, of course, we can. But he did not address the consequences. But when a party, of course, does not follow a court's order, then the court may go one of the sanction provisions of the Texas rules, and we feel that that's what the court would do, but that has not been addressed.
Would you still object if the district court required the master to submit his hours spent on this case from time to time, reviewed those hours, set a fee for them, and then ruled the parties for those costs as he thought they ought to be divided periodically during the case?
No, Your Honor, we would not in this case. And I sort of gets on to the second argument, but basically, to have the parties, particularly defendants, who involuntarily are sued, who did not ask to be here, who are entitled to have the judge, duly elected judge, hear their defense that they have done nothing wrong, to have even periodically court costs, or I should say attorney's fees for the Master of Chancery, we feel, again, are an impediment to the courts, the right of access.
So I ask, would you not object? You would object,
yes,
even if the payment system were restructured?
Yes. Of course.
Well, what kind of, let's suppose we're going to have the judge look at all documents in the case and do all hearings on when records should be open to the press or not. And in other words, we would say you cannot have any masters charge money for their services because that violates the open court provision. What kind of delay is constitutionally acceptable in getting a case from filing to trial?
Well, first of all, we submit that there are other avenues that would not cause a delay. But before we get to that, answer
I'm
your question.
I'm real anxious to hear those.
Yeah.
Because
okay.
The trial bench around the state is telling this court that you're putting us in a situation where we have very little time to actually to try cases. Because
yes,
you on the Supreme Court want the pretrial to be just right. You want
right
it to be perfect, and you want a defensive hearing, and you don't want to ever not have a hearing if you can't have a hearing.
Mm-hmm.
If there's ever that option, you want a lengthy procedure, and when are we going to try cases?
Well, as you all can well understand and relate, that the attorneys of record want a speedy trial as much as the appellate courts. But to deny the litigants their constitutional rights just to speed up the process, we think is going too far. The federal court system, of course, has an answer to this. They have the magistrate system. Dallas County has masters for the juvenile cases. They have masters for the probate cases.
The legislature's not going to have any more money for the foreseeable future for the court system.
Assuming
which
that
I think is a real
realistic scenario. Assuming that the Dallas County coffers cannot afford an additional master to hear this, then we submit that in lieu of LaCora versus Hanlon, let's have a reasonable fee. Let's not have $10,000 in advance before any time is expended to a plaintiff who's on Social Security, and Mr. Tillery will address those issues as to his clients, and defendants who have to pay their own attorneys just to say that they have done nothing wrong. That should not be a requirement to speed up the court's docket. Now, that goes along with the argument as to whether this is an exceptional case, whether by virtue of having 18 defendants and one plaintiff, with everyone submitting discovery questions and answers coming forth and objections thereto, is that in and of itself an exceptional case? The Texas courts have held that is not.
I'm a little unclear about your position as to how all this fits under the open court provision. Is it your contention then that it is all right for a trial judge under the open court provision to make use of a master, but it is the payment method that is the problem here? poses a conflict with the provision?
It is a payment method that inhibits the parties' access, the first prong of the test, to the courts. Yes. We're not saying that, I'll make it clear for the record, that 171 in and of itself ab initio is violative of the Constitution, nor is Section 54 of the Government Code involving masters, particularly those in Dallas County, is unconstitutional. We are not saying that. But to assess cost of $10,000, and that's just the initial cost before anything is done, prohibits the parties to pursue their case. It casts a chilling effect on discovery. It attaches a price tag to each discovery motion. And you'll note in the order, it does not take into account who files the motion. It is constant. So if one defendant wished to be a little more aggressive or had more problem with various requests, each party ante's up the same. Well, that may sound, well, how can you balance that? Well, the plaintiff has to pay regardless whether she files nothing. Each defendant has to pay regardless. This system, we feel, violates the open course, and this court has held in other cases, in Dillingham versus Putnam, this court held that a receiver who had to post a double supersedious bond just before he could appeal was unconstitutional. That's posting a fee. Also, in Eustis versus the city of Henrietta, there it was a tax case, and defendants had to pay their taxes before they could bring their defense in a sale, in a tax sale case. So this is not a case of first impression as far as the nature of the complaint, that is, having to post a bond or post money or pay fees in advance before we can even have the case heard, before we even get to the trial to have the discovery matters heard.
Well, coming back to my question, if the district judge structured it such that he got a report from the master, and the master said, during the last 3 months, the plaintiff filed 10 motions. 5 were frivolous and 5 were meritorious, and they all took about the same amount of time. And the same period of time, the defendants filed the same number, and the same number were meritorious and the same were frivolous, and it cost me this many, it took this much time, and my ordinary rate is $175 an hour, and I recommend that you tax the cost 50% to the defendants and 50% to the plaintiffs, and the trial judge agreed to do that. Do you have any objection to that procedure?
Yes, we would, because that still would give open unreasonable fees, even though it may be related to the number of motions filed and to and by whom those motions were filed. It still requests the parties to pay for justice, to pay to have discovery motions heard when a duly elected judge who is supported by the taxes of the state ought to be able to hear this.
So your position basically that use of a master by a judge in discovery proceedings does not in and of itself violate the open court provision, but if the master gets paid anything, it does.
If he gets paid in advance like we are here, the rule says taxes court costs, which is another issue.
Well, I don't think Judge Heck's question suggested that it had to be beforehand. He was talking about afterwards, I believe.
Well, the timing is not quite as important as the amount. And under that scenario, we would still have the possibility of having an egregious amount regardless. And so it's
a coming. Is an hourly rate that's comparable to what lawyers charge, what you charge your client for services, is that an egregious amount?
For, in this procedure, yes. Because here, we have 100...
Well, I mean,
I realize
the problem of well, okay. Isn't there a problem of getting somebody that's smart enough to make the correct ruling or a price? Is this something that a judge can require in order to do as part of the duties of being an officer of the court?
What, to serve as a master?
Yes. You just have to do it? Is that an alternative?
Having the parties in the litigation?
No.
No,
I
just
mean,
other practicing attorneys.
Yeah, practicing attorneys have to... take criminal cases on a son, mm-hmm. whether they want to or not. Can practicing attorney be required to be masters for a fee that you feel does not violate the Constitution?
We feel that would be a more viable alternative, although, again, you have a donating of a lot of time, and what's reasonable, a certain fee to be paid. But like under Section 54, the compensation of those masters paid by the county funds, the court can still tax costs. But under McCord versus Hamlin, those fees still have to be reasonable. If it can be subbed in a scheme where the fees are reasonable, then yes.
What's not reasonable? $175 an hour should be 25, or the number of hours, or the kinds of things that he... What's not reasonable about this procedure?
What's not reasonable about this procedure is the fact that, yes, $175 an hour. Two, the posting in advance, $10,000 a fee.
Let's set the advance aside.
Okay.
Assume the judge has the docket that is after the fact, that it's an actual charge of how much has been incurred. Now, you're saying the hourly rate has to be a fraction of what someone would charge for to apply this knowledge in the private sector.
Yes, because the parties are already paying an hourly rate to their counsel. This amounts to paying two attorneys to have your defense heard from the viewpoint of the defendant, of course. But the other systems in place, although create somewhat of a tax burden to the public, are more in line with what we feel the spirit of the open courts is. Have the parties come in and not have a judge make the parties pay a prohibitive amount to have their case heard. And that is our first issue.
And you think this court has the power to say to the legislature, you haven't created enough courts to take care of the business that this court has generated through its rules.
And
you have to come up with a scheme where some governmental entity pays for a quasi-judicial officer to comply with another rule that we think.
If this case will so slow down this court, this particular court, then yes, there needs to be another scheme, whether the legislature has to create another court or whether the legislature has to create or expand on Section 54 and have a master appointed in Dallas County to hear pretrial matters in cases to help expedite cases in the district courts.
It's been a long time since I've been on the trial bench, but I hear stories about trial judges rewarding their friends by giving them lucrative fees of this kind as receiverships and ad litems, some quite handsome fees. In your judgment, is this a problem generally? I'm not going to ask about this because get yourself in trouble with yourself. But do you think this is a problem in the profession today?
I think to some extent this, generally, yes, this can be a problem. My specific knowledge of it being actually a problem in Dallas County, I don't know. But this would definitely open itself up to not only political patronage, but to this type of scenario that you are definitely alluding to here today. I would like to give additional time in the opening to Mr. Tillery, and I'll address some other issues on the rebuttal.
Thank you,
sir.
Wow. Yes, would you give Mr. Tillery the amount of time he would have had if Mr. Frazier had not been asked all the questions?
Thank you. May it please the court. I represent basically the plaintiffs who are at the trial court level. I think from our position, we obviously have a much different situation than the defendants in the way that we were affected by this order. Number one, we filed the affidavit of inability to pay the costs associated with the master that was appointed. There was no contest to that affidavit. The order of the court did not find, nor did it set forth the reasons as required by Rule 145, that the plaintiffs had the ability to pay the cost in this case. The affidavit, as I stated, was uncontested, and it showed Mrs. Simpson and her daughters to be in very meager financial circumstances. This case is basically as a result of the death of Mr. Simpson, Mrs. Simpson's husband, and the father of Tina and Tanya. Mr. Simpson worked for 25 years as a coder operator in an aluminum plant. He developed cancer. He died. During that period of time, Mrs. Simpson rendered nursing services to him, and the lawsuit was brought against the defendants, who undeniably supplied materials for the coding process during this 25-year period. It's not an exceptional case. It's not a complex case. It's only a case with many parties, because The issue is very clear, simply an issue of causation.
Mr. Tillery, do you agree that the district judge can appoint a master over discovery and pretrial matters under Rules 171?
Under 171, Your Honor, I would feel like, and I would have an objection and serious concerns that any litigant, be it a defendant who's drug into the court and under the argument responsible for nothing, has to pay to exercise the statutory rules of procedure. And for that basis, whenever you have a price tag associated with the exercise, not of marshaling evidence and acquiring evidence, but in actually having your objections and exercising your statutory rights of procedure, while the legislature may eliminate those rights, once we have those rights, you can't arbitrarily attach a price tag to the exercise of those rights. And I feel like, in this case, it is an arbitrary attachment if it's to eliminate, basically, court congestion.
So in your view, what kinds of things can a master be appointed for under Rule 171?
I would say, as in the cases where they've been used most extensively, from my knowledge, in Dallas County, you have the juvenile and the probate and the family courts, where there is a lot of evaluation of property. I know there's the one case that was an antitrust case that was elaborate in that particular documents and valuations took expertise. And I feel like that was the historical basis for Rule 71. When you have a unique problem, maybe accounting situation, valuation problem, or...
So if you had that kind of a problem here, maybe just a tremendous amount of documents to go through, would it have been all right to appoint a master?
No, Your Honor, because once again, that goes to basically congestion or inconvenience to the court.
Scientific documents that the judge isn't going to be able to understand whether they're relevant.
Well, under a scientific document theory question, I'm not sure that that goes to what we're talking about here is a master for exercising discovery rights. Do we get to see those scientific documents? Now, whether or not there's a particular application or a particular expertise required in the application of those scientific documents to the case, I think then you have an exceptional circumstance or a unique situation that maybe you need a nuclear scientist.
Is that the standard you're suggesting, that you can only use a master when some peculiar specialized expertise is necessary that the judge might not have himself or herself?
Yes, sir, because I think that's what 171 was historically for, and I think that's what it says, a complex, exceptional case.
The fact that there's a volume of materials to go through that could take hours, days, weeks, for the judge to go through, that's not, under Rule 171, a sufficient basis. It has to be some matter requiring unique, specialized expertise.
Yes, and that's my position.
So, to be quite clear on that, if you requested the production of 10,000 documents, very voluminous documents, and the defendants claimed they were privileged and went to the trouble of complying with the procedures to perfect that claim, listing them all, specifying the privilege and why and so on, and requesting an in-camera inspection to determine the propriety of the privilege or not, under your theory, the district judge just got to sit there and go through them. And if it takes him a while...
And there's a very good protection upon that in the rule, Rule 215. If I request these overly voluminous, unnecessary social documents, or if the defendants do not wish to present them, and they're wrong, and it's not a legitimate exercise of their statutory rights, then 215 would apply to prevent that type of hanky-panky.
But I was assuming that both sides are in good faith and they both have good faith claims. In that event, it's just going to take as long as it takes, and the district judge just has to do it.
I don't know that in that case he would have to do it. The question here is, can he appoint a master and assign basically a private litigation type of structure because the parties want to exercise the rights that were given by the legislature and the rules of procedure?
Assuming that you're mistaken about that for purposes of my question and what you can and cannot do under Rule 171, would you have had a complaint if the judge had simply said that he was taxing the cost of the master, that he treated his taxable court costs, whoever lost the case would end up paying those costs.
Okay. If I were wrong in my assertion that it did not take the type of my understanding of complexity and uniqueness,
right,
that he does have the right to do it,
right,
then I would have no objection because the rule specifically says that he shall assess compensation for that master, and it specifically says it shall be taxed at cost.
But
that,
by
fair.
The same, by the same procedure, he could rule for costs along the way.
He could for accrued.
Right, that, and that was the burden of my question to your colleague, was that if he did it after the fact, after the time was spent, rather than before, which is part of your objection.
Again, going upon the premise that...
You wouldn't have so much problem with that because you think you have a good affidavit of inability to pay, and the rule says if you can't pay it, the defendant has to.
Well, Your Honor, I don't mean to be flippant about it,
no,
but I do feel like I have a good affidavit, and
yeah.
I think the case law stands for the fact that if it is accrued, then the court can make orders.
You're in the trenches more than any of us, of course. Is there a problem, in your opinion, with the amount of pretrial work a judge has? Does that impinge upon some constitutional right if it judges are spending more time on pretrial than they are on trying cases?
As I understand your question, first of all, yes, I do think the courts, the trial courts, are really having a problem with this pretrial. I think a more diligent use and exercise of Rule 215 would help, but I do think that at some point there becomes such a burden upon the trial courts on this pretrial issue that if something has to be done to get relief, and I think we're close to a situation where this court does have the authority to order the legislature to do something, to formulate a remedy, not to deprive constitutional rights to exercise your statutory rights. Now, once again, they don't have...
Statutory, I mean, what's causing most of this are rules that the court itself has created. I mean, it's not so much the new statutes or new causes of action that's increasing the pretrial. That may be increasing the total number of cases, I don't know. But the looking through the documents, these various kinds of hearings, what we're dealing with here are largely caused by rules this court has promulgated.
Yes, sir, and it may be up to this court to fashion rules to accommodate that, but I don't think you can start assigning a price tag to the exercise of rules that you've given us, because it has a chilling effect on all parties as to the exercise of their rights, the full exercise of their rights.
You don't have a problem with the accrual of the cost of such a master, then at the end of the case, the cost being assessed to the loser.
Well, assuming the threshold premise that I have is error, and the court has the right to assign in the extraordinary case, then I have no problem with what the rule says, that it be taxed as cost against the losing party.
Isn't it almost any case with 18 defendants an exceptional case?
By definition, the number of parties? No, sir, I don't think so, especially not in the issue in this case is causation. And they were out there.
Well, each one of the 18 claiming that one of the other 17 did it. I mean, the permutations get kind of astronomical.
And I understand. I guess it. I don't think per se you can say do the number of the parties in a case. Is 17 okay? Is 16 okay? I think you have to look at the facts of this case. And it's not an exceptional case, and the number of parties don't make it such.
Any other questions? Thank you, Tim. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Thomas Cox will present argument for respondents.
May it please the court, I'm here today representing Judge Canales in this proceeding. And in my comments to the court, I would like to respond in three distinct manners. Comments as to the plaintiff's complaints, and comments as to the defendant's complaints, and finally the judge's position in this matter. Now, there's one thing that I wish to cover at the initial start. There was a comment made.
Are you representing a real party in it?
No, sir. I'm representing Judge Canales.
You're not in this case otherwise.
I'm not in this case otherwise. I am corporate counsel for an entity in Dallas. I have not received any appointments from Judge Canales. I am doing this as a favor. Let that be perfectly clear. I am not one of the people. $175 or $25 an hour, mine is zero today.
Well, keep that in mind, engaging the tone of the question.
Thank you, Judge. I think they commented it was chilling on effect upon discovery. It's not a chilling effect upon discovery, there isn't. It's a chilling effect upon discovery disputes. Now, turning the attention to the plaintiff's complaints, the only order before the court today is the amended order appointing the master. There is nothing before the court today concerning the overruling of the affidavit or lack thereof. So I think, one, it shouldn't even be considered. I think it was incumbent upon the plaintiffs in this plaintiffs in the trial court to come forward with an order on from the judge overruling their affidavit of indigency. Now, number two,
isn't it overruled as a matter of law or not?
I don't think it's overruled as a matter of law. He has made a modification of that they are to get some security for cost, but there isn't a finding before the court that they're not indigent. He has simply said that $200 is an appropriate fee that they should be able to pay. And once again, we have to look back to what their initial filing fees were. I mean, they were able to meet the filing fees, but somehow now they're unable to meet $200 a month.
Let me make sure I'm understanding. I thought the Pauper's affidavit was uncontested.
Well, I'll go directly to that then, Judge. The Pauper's affidavit fails to meet the requirements of Rule 145 upon its face.
Did anybody challenge it?
I don't think it's incumbent upon anybody to challenge it. The judge has that authority. If he looks at an affidavit and says, this does not conform with the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, on his own merit,
Isn't there a certain time period for this procedure? He can't just somewhere down the line, a year or two later, make a ruling.
Can it 30 days or 10 days?
Well, according to the rules on your Pauper's affidavit in Rule 145, it has to be done at the time of the filing of the petition. And then there are also some appellate provisions concerning Pauper's oath. For example, in Rule 145.5.1, it says upon the filing of the affidavit, which is tied to the filing of the original complaint. So what we have here is they've waited at least six months after the filing of the complaint and then said, well, we're basically indigent, we're a pauper. They submitted some documents, an affidavit, which did not include, as was pointed out in the hearing before the court, bank accounts, property owned, cash on hand. They failed on their face to comply with the requirements of Rule 145.2 that says the affidavit shall contain complete information as to the party's identity, nature and amount of governmental entitlement income, nature and amount of employment income, other income, spouse's income if available, property owned, cash or checking accounts, dependent debts and monthly expenses. They, on the face, did not meet that.
My question was, isn't it too late for you to raise those things?
I think it is for them to raise it now at this time. If they were going to raise it, they needed to file it at the time of their affidavit. But assuming that we're going to say during the proceeding at any time, because of due process or constitutional requirements, they can raise that, I'm saying they even failed to follow the proper form for the affidavit. I'm saying, yes, they are too late, but if for constitutional requirements they are allowed to challenge at any time during the litigation, they still didn't do it right. And the judge still gave them an opportunity to come forward. The judge has been over backwards to hear their comments as to why they were indigent, and it's found that they weren't.
Well, has he been over backwards to hear pretrial discovery matters, or has he just kind of delegated that whole responsibility to somebody else?
That goes into the question of, is it a complex nature of the cases?
Well, has he heard any pretrial discovery at all of any type, any time, any place in this case?
I'm not sure, Judge.
As I understand, the order, instead of taking all the responsibility of doing any of it, or taking some that was hard and some that was easy, he said, you guys have more. I've got better things to do.
He has made a determination that the increased cost involved in the appointment of master will be outweighed by the expediting of the case, save time for the parties in the long range. There's a balancing act that the judge has gone through that will say, by doing this, money will be saved farther down the road.
Now, in this particular... Where does that reflect? I mean, all I see in the record is that a total of 8 motions were filed. Now, that 8 motions, regardless of how many parties you have in the case, does not strike me as an exceptional case. In fact, I would say it was an exceptional case that didn't have a base statement.
Well, I think in that regard, as to whether it is an exceptional case, the judge found in his order in the first paragraph that it's a toxic tort. We have products liability claims. We have 18 defendants. We have an origin of a lawsuit that commenced in 1964. It's multitudinous and complex. We have counterclaims, cross-claims, and a large number of pretrial and discovery issues. That was eight pending motions seeking hearings. This isn't how much discovery was put out. This is how many discovery disputes we've already generated. The file right now, after only, well, at the time this was placed, basically been frozen since the time that this order came down. At that time, the file of the court's jacket was already a foot thick. I submit that it is a complex case, and it is. We've mentioned earlier, we've got 18 defendants, all of whom saying they didn't do it. I mean, you've got a causation problem on the present. Each one of those 18, and the 18 have got your cross-actions going back and forth and saying, I didn't do it. Now, I think what the judge has tried to do here is that this is a complex case. Rule 171 clearly exists as a tool to aid the trial bench in the state of Texas. He's tried to be innovative and move these complex cases along. I think there was a question about at what time does delay become unconstitutional. Leaving that aside, justice delayed is justice denied, and the judge is trying to expedite his cases. Now, we recognize that there are the cases itself is not enough to appoint a master, but I think the judge, the trial bench in the state, has the authority to take each of these factors into consideration, and eventually you reach the conclusion that a master is justified and called for in this case.
How can this charging scheme be constitutional under LaCroix if the modest increase in the filing fee, less than a dozen of the filing fee, was unconstitutional, denying access?
It's my understanding of LaCroix that went directly to the state general fund and not to the administration of the judicial system.
So
in this case,
they had $1,000 filing fee that went to make sure that us judges had the kind of cars and houses we deserved, that wouldn't violate the Constitution simply because of the practical matter a lot of people couldn't afford it.
You have to excuse me if I defer on the house and the car, but I think the open courts provision is not unlimited. We recognize security for cost. I think it has to be reasonable. And I think you'd have to approach that on a case-by-case basis.
LaCroix says this.
Is it reasonable to order the plaintiff to pay $200 a month from now on? I mean, I suppose that would facilitate an early trial if the judge could get to it, but doesn't that strike you as being a little heavy?
No, and I'll tell you why, Judge. I think they've had to pay probably almost $2,000, $1,000 to $2,000 in filing fees to start the litigation. So over that time, if we take $200 a month, we're taking over a two-year period. I think you can safely say the case should probably be disposed of within that time, at probably about the same amount. Secondly, I think you have to consider the cost of deposition discovery in a practical matter as compared to the total costs that are going to be incurred by the plaintiffs in this case. The $200 a month is a minor part.
What if they never file a motion?
I think at that point, they could ask for relief from the judge from that.
What part? A couple of
years? Have to ask the judge or have to ask the master?
The judge prepared the appointment, but once again, the order allows the appeal. Pardon?
It's an unlimited appointment, isn't it?
Well, I want to make it clear to the court that the judge did not intend for this case to be tried by the master. His intent is that it be discovery matters and pretrial procedures.
Oh, but isn't the idea that he shows up for jury selection? And everything up until that point is done by somebody else and never elected by the people?
That is, in general, he is trying to expedite the case and limit the issues.
And isn't that an incentive to the judge to head for the golf course?
I suppose you could look at it like that. I think to the judge, it's an incentive to expedite the cases, to try to be innovative in handling complex litigation. He's attempting to be innovative in this case, and if the courts say that the judge must hear everything, I think then we have to get to the point of the constitutionality of Rule 171, the government code, and all the other things we've talked about.
Do you have any specific findings about what it is about this case that's unique?
Other than what I've listed, the 8 points that are reflected in his order, toxic tort, products liability, number of defendants, cross actions, cross claims, by that very nature, I think none of those factors in and of itself, if you say just because a case is a toxic tort, that makes it a complex case, no, that's not right. But if you take all of the factors, the number of defendants, you look at it in total, then you can come to the reasonable conclusion that it's a complex case.
Without ever having heard a single motion.
Well, I think the judge analyzed the case and made the determination that it was a complex and to move it along that
he was going to appoint a master. In seeking guidance, if the court says the judge should hold a hearing and make those determinations and not make it on his own motion, I think that would be instructive to the trial bench in this case.
Do we know what motions were pending at the time that he entered this order?
8 discovery disputes. Now, I think it's important that there was some discussion about the method of payment. What the judge is required here is that certain amounts of money be placed in a trust account. They can only be withdrawn at the time that the services are incurred. It is not taxing the cost at this time. He is simply requiring the parties to give security during the litigation for costs that may be incurred and assessed at some later date. And I think if we look at the case of the executors of the state versus Tart, 531 Southwest 2nd, 696, it was an ad litem case, and I think this is both applicable to ad litems and applicable to masters. Both are officers of the court. And what that case said was, you're going to assess these costs of the ad litems as we go along during the course of the litigation. Well, you wouldn't be able to have ad litems, you wouldn't be able to have masters if you're going to wait and assess by taxing of the cost at the end of litigation. Nobody wants to serve for free as a master, particularly in cases like this where you may be looking at several years before there's any payment. The lawyers of the state, I don't think, are prepared to do that. And once again, that case, they said, just as other costs of suit may be assessed from time to time as the suit progresses, so may the fees and expenses of the attorney ad litem be assessed and paid from time to time during the litigation. And once again, I think Rule 143 also states that a party seeking affirmative relief may be required to give security for costs. And it goes on to say it on the court's own motion. Now, I think the proper procedure in this thing, and it's been alluded to, is there's been a waiver, I believe, or the judge believes, in the start of the complaints. Now, the judge in this case has appointed a master. Parties, and I think it's important at the trial court, the plaintiff, unlike today, did not complain about the appointment of the master. They only complained about the fees and the assessment. Now, today, they're complaining about the master. I think they've waived any right to complain about the appointment of master by failing to do it in the trial court. But now, as to the defendants that complained, the judge said, okay, folks, I'm going to have a hearing. You tell me why this is not a complex case. You tell me why I shouldn't appoint a master under Rule 171. Tell me why. Now, we had a hearing, and basically nobody told the judge anything.
The plaintiff says, I'm broke. I'm a pauper. I can't afford the $200 a month.
He said they can't afford the $200 a month, but other places in that transcript, they said, we're not complaining of the appointment of the master. We're complaining about the fees being assessed. If you tax all the fees against the defendants, it wouldn't bother us at all. And that's what they basically said in the transcript at the time. So you've given them the opportunity to contest it. The burden is on the parties contesting, or it should be on the parties contesting the appointment of the master. They basically did not do that.
Well, a fair reading of the statement of facts, sort of reading between the lines, as appellate courts always have to do since we weren't there, looks like that the judge gave everybody pretty short shrift on this stuff. Looks like he was pretty well convinced that he was going to appoint a master in this case, and he wasn't about to listen to the contrary.
Well, with all due respect, Judge, the original came in, Mr. Coles was complaining about appointment of magistrate under the government code, and halfway through he found out he hadn't been appointed under the government code, but under Rule 171. I think that shows a little ill-preparedness on the part of the defendants in this case when they get their opportunity and they're complaining about the wrong statute. He may have been short-shift, but it may have been because they completely missed the boat.
Even if there's some obligation on the child voters to keep his finger in the pie, I'm referring to the Howell's Leather Company, which is not this court, you know, it's the Supreme Court. But the idea of just turning the whole case over until trial as opposed to examining motions on a case-by-case basis. I mean, there's some discovery motions that would be real easy and others that might take a day or 2 days.
I think once again the judge has been trying to be innovative in using Rule 171. If the court gives guidance to the trial bench in that regard, I don't think Judge Canales would have a problem with that. In this case, he has turned it over,
but you also have to remember that by his order, parties are dissatisfied with rulings, they have the right to appeal those rulings to the judge. So his finger to extend still is in the case, and parties still can make use of the judge. He has not precluded the parties from going to him. He just said, you have to go to the master first on these pretrial and discovery issues. So to that extent, his finger still is in the cake or the pot. And once again, I think this court has held on many occasions that appointment of a master should be reversed or overturned only for clear abuse of discretion. And I think when looking at abuse of discretion, you look to see, has the judge followed guiding principles in this case? And I think based upon the prior law, that he has followed guiding principles, he's tried to be innovative in this regard, and has tried to move this litigation along and help the trial bench in the state of Texas.
This does not appear to be a form order, either one of them. Is there anything in the record that would indicate whether that's true or not, that it is not a form order?
It is not a form order. It was created in regard to this case after the comments, because the original order, I think, assessed both costs equally against both plaintiffs and defendants. After the hearing, he modified that and tried to take into account all of the concerns that folks might not that might have about not being able to go to him for these disputes.
I don't suppose that, since most of the record is attached to the briefs, that there's anything in the record that addresses how common this practice is in this particular court, in the 298, or in any other court in Dallas County, or in any other court in the state, for that matter.
Judge, I know Judge Canales has utilized this procedure in the past. In my practice, which is mainly medical malpractice litigation, I have not seen it utilized. I'm not saying it doesn't exist in other courts. I can't respond to that. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
Boy, there are a lot of things to talk about. First of all, in Judge Canales' court, there is another case where a master in chancery was appointed, although it's not the record, but it is a public record, and the Delta crash case, over $70,000 in master in chancery fees has already been assessed and taxed to the parties, so it has happened before.
Is that an exceptional case?
I don't know the facts of that case, Your Honor. I cannot respond to that.
How much did the master get?
$70,000. The case is not over. The case is not over. This, however, is not an exceptional case. There were 8 discovery motions on file. 6 of those were motions to compel. 2 were motions for protective order. No oral deposition had been taken. 1 written deposition, or deposition by written questions, has been taken. You look at the cases, historically and repeatedly, masters have been appointed in accounting cases. You look at the cases, most of them divorce cases, where there is a very large estate, very large community property estate. Salvage business.
Masters handle divorce cases in Dallas routinely, don't they? Don't they virtually handle every family law case in Dallas?
There is a provision, Your Honor, under Section 54 for family law matters. Here, though, these masters are appointed under Rule 171 to do an accounting of the nature of the community property, as well as probate cases, but still under 171, not under the government code. There are various cases that say that, okay, if we have a salvage business, for instance, there's one case that concerned a salvage business. Well, that was a man versus man case. Well, there was no way to get a fair market value of that case. So master in chancery came in, and a lot of these are, they're accountants with specialties that the trial judge does not have. Accountants, CPAs, and other cases, divorce cases, the estate was very, very large. Here, we don't have that. Here, the master is not being used as to assist the fact finder. And that's the way a master in chancery has been used. He's to assist the fact finder. Look at the facts. Look at the evidence. Look at the estate. What's community? What's not? What's the value? Here, this is not a matter in equity. That is the test in Rule 171, to have powers as a master in chancery in courts of equity. He's here making decisions of law.
But the only difference between the conduct of statutory masters in family courts in Dallas and this master, in this case, is that one's under a statute, one's under a rule, and one's paid by the state and one's paid by the partners. Aren't those the only two differences? They're both making the same kind of decisions. In fact, in family courts, the masters are deciding temporary orders as a practical matter. Isn't that true?
Yeah, those are the differences. Here, of course, the manner of paying the fees is different than that comprised under the code. And that's another difference, which goes to what you have just stated.
You say the reference to the equity courts in Rule 171 puts a limitation by the rules on this man, on a civil court master's power that is not present in the statutory masters within our larger cities for the family courts.
Yes, Your Honor, because the rule mentions equity. Section 54 mentions tax cases and any other matters in Dallas County. So there is a distinction. And to have an attorney, a practicing attorney, involved in cases with some of these attorneys in this case, to hear discovery matters, we feel goes beyond the scope and intent of 171.
If there were a statute which provided for the appointment of masters for the civil courts in Dallas, for example, paid for by the state or by the county, by public funds, to whom could be referred all pretrial matters, would you have an objection to that statute as being unconstitutional?
No, Your Honor, as if it were, of course, couched as the current statutes, masters.
It really boils down to who's going to pay for it. Is that what this boils down to?
Yes. Texas has not required the litigants to pay as they go through discovery. It required a reasonable filing fee, McCord versus Hanlon, and then the duly elected judge to hear their case. And if a defendant wants to file a counterclaim, yes, there's a filing fee to serve the counter-defendant. But a defendant should not, who does not want to be there, who has done nothing unless proven otherwise, have to pay fees to have routine discovery matters heard. And these are routine. These are motions to compel. These are motions for protective order under 166B3D. So there's nothing exceptional about this case. There's nothing at all. In fact, Krigler versus Hyde states that the court is on the court's burden to show in the order the reason for good cause. This order does not do that. Again, this order is open and broad. It just says any and all authority given by 171. That's what the order states on its face. So we are looking at virtually every single matter that a judge would hear after we call the jury, before the first witness is put on to be heard by this master in chancery, Mr. Sibley, and we have to pay for that. And we feel that violates the Texas Constitution, and more importantly, on the second point that I would like to briefly make just for a second, is that this is not an exceptional case. The judge did not show good cause, and the matter of taxation is contrary to Rule 171. Therefore, on behalf of all the relators, the petitioners, we pray that the judge's amended order be vacated because it violates the Texas Constitution and otherwise violates the scope and intent of Rule 171.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the business of the court. Oh, you have a...
I have 3 minutes.
Does he have 3 minutes?
Yes, sir.
All right.
It better be good.
You have 3 minutes.
It better be good.
I just have one serious question off the top. It seems like there was some suggestion made that plaintiff had never complained of the order that was entered, the original order that was entered on June of 89, the motion to modify attacking that order was filed in July of 89, and then I immediately went from that order when the amended order came in, changing the structure and overruling, in effect, my affidavit of inability to pay costs. I immediately sought petition of mandamus out of the Dallas Court of Appeals by myself. That was denied. Motion for rehearing was filed. That was there was a change in it. I filed a second motion for rehearing, and then at that time, as I can recall, the defendants who had brought their own out joined together and brought it up. So if that's not in the
the file, then there's not a complete file regarding the efforts I made to perfect the complaint. Now, as regarding whether or not there would be any objection to a master appointed to hear basically under the statute saying they can refer discovery and so forth, I would have an objection because I feel like the judge was elected to hear those items either that are matters of procedure, matter of statutory rights that I have, or constitutional rights. And that's why the citizens elect them, so that they will sit in judgment of these issues.
So visiting judges are unconstitutional?
Unless there's a special circumstance of illness, something that requires the court to go forward, I do have a problem with visiting judges. Now, there has been
judges are appointed that haven't been elected yet, so there's 60% of the judges.
Well, if there's a vacancy in office, and I don't see that the Constitution prohibits.
How about the 83% of the judicial elections that are unopposed?
Well, but they are elected.
Okay, but they only have to vote for themselves and they win.
Excuse me?
You only have to vote for yourself and you win because we don't count right in.
I guess that's due to the choice that some folks didn't want to run in that particular race. Again, I feel like the plaintiff's case stands clearly, even if there was a valid order. They disregarded the inability, and this court has twice held that when an appellate court or a trial court disregards an affidavit of inability to pay costs in the absence of a contest by the parties, that is an abuse of discretion in and of itself.
Any other questions? Thank you, Ken. Business of the court is now concluded. Marshal, please adjourn the court.